My name is Sally Steenland, and I'm the director of the Faith and Progressive Policy Initiative at the Center for American Progress. With me today is Joelle Novy, who's executive director of Greater Washington Interfaith Power and Light, a group that works with hundreds of congregations all across the D.C. area to save energy, go green, and respond to climate change. Joelle, welcome. We're so glad you're with us
Thank
today.
You.
Let's start off with a story that's in the headlines, which is the conference that's going on in Durban, South Africa right now on climate change. There are hundreds of scientists there, political leaders, and advocates who are talking about the health of the planet. Faith groups are there too. Can you just talk a little bit about what distinctive value faith groups bring to these discussions?
Yes, I think there are two valuable things that faith voice can bring to international climate negotiations. The first is a sense of our humanity being more important than what country we're from. Many faith communities extend beyond country boundaries and have international connections and congregations all over the world, and many religious communities are deeply involved and have strong connections with mission work in other countries around the world. So I think that message that we're human beings first and which country we happen to come from is secondary, is a valuable reminder for the negotiators at Durban. I think the second voice that is uniquely important for the faith community to bring in the international climate sphere is about responsibility. We talk a lot in the United States, we talk a little bit in the United States about climate adaptation and about making it possible for the developing countries around the world that are on the front lines of the climate crisis, where people are suffering first and most, that the United States should help them in some way. But that conversation in our political sphere is almost entirely about humanitarian aid, as if they were victims of some natural disaster, as if this were like the Haiti earthquake or something else that just was bad luck for some other country that we should try to help them out because we're nice. And I work in congregations throughout the D.C. area. I've gone to synagogues, I've gone to churches, I've gone to congregations of all faith traditions, and in every one of those communities, people are teaching their children that if you do something that hurts someone else, that you have a responsibility to apologize and to make it right. And that's the simple message that we should be bringing to international climate negotiations. The United States has played an outsized role in causing the climate pollution that is causing the climate crisis, that is causing tremendous human suffering in these other countries. And the right language to talk about what we should be doing about that is the language of responsibility, culpability and responsibility. And I think the faith community has been almost unique in using the language of responsibility and moral obligation to talk about climate adaptation assistance.
So if a miracle would happen in Durban, and if things that should happen actually did happen, what would you like to see happen there?
I would like to see in Durban a binding, aggressive treaty for all of the countries of the world that would put us on a course to bring the concentrations of carbon dioxide and other heat-trapping climate pollution in our atmosphere down to 350 parts per million, which is what scientists tell us is the highest safe level for life to continue as we are familiar with it on Earth. And I would like to see an acknowledgement of responsibility by the largest emitter nations to make right and provide significant, meaningful adaptation assistance to the countries that did the least to cause this problem but are among the first to suffer from it.
Just one more quick question on Durban. If you've been following it in the news, as other people have, how far is your hope from the reality? What do you think is going to happen there, if anything?
Everything I've heard is that there's no real hope of that kind of international cooperation or acknowledgement of responsibility by the major emitter nations, and certainly that we don't currently have the political will in the United States to take that kind of leadership role. It's very heartbreaking.
Yeah. So let's go from international to the local level, which is where you do your work in organizing. And Greater Washington Interfaith Power and Light was recently involved in the very effective, I would say, protests against the Keystone XL pipeline. Tell us what you did and why you opposed the pipeline.
Yeah, so Interfaith Power and Light here in the D.C. area is one of over 38 state affiliates of Interfaith Power and Light that are working with over 14,000 congregations across the country to respond to the climate crisis. And our entire network was very involved in speaking out against the Keystone XL pipeline, including especially some of the Interfaith Power and Light colleagues I have in the pipeline states, Kansas, Nebraska, Texas in particular. We opposed the Keystone XL pipeline, first of all, for what it is, because it would have brought the dirtiest oil extracted from the Canadian tar sands through across about 1,700 miles and six states to from Canada to the Gulf of Mexico, endangering aquifers from which many Americans get their drinking water. And the extraction of this oil is very, very intensive on the climate, even more so than regular oil extraction. Climate scientist James Hansen has said that the full exploitation of these unconventional fossil fuels like tar sands oil would mean game over for the climate. So we were very concerned about the pipeline proposed for those reasons. There was a sense that the president had said in running for president that this would be the generation that saw a turning away from fossil fuels. And here was a decision that his administration could make alone without congressional help. And not only was it looking like the pipeline would be approved, but the president hadn't used the word climate in a speech in several years. So there was a feeling of a chance to really ask, are we as a nation going to reconcile with the climate crisis. Our engagement with our congregations was on several fronts. A number of religious leaders made a decision to risk arrest in front of the White House as part of the series of arrests of about 1,200 Americans that took place in late August and early September. We turned out for several different rallies. I spoke at one at the end of those 2 weeks, and I quoted the prophet Isaiah, who says, he said, "Is this the fast that I desire?" And I ask, is this the pipeline that God desires of us? You know, we do need pipelines to connect us with each other, to connect. We do need to feel more connected with other people and with other places, but we need pipelines of solidarity. We need pipelines of compassion. We need pipelines of ingenuity, but I suspect that this is not the pipeline that God desires of us. We signed postcards, comment cards to the State Department. Hundreds of comment cards were signed by people who had that opportunity after services at their congregations. Our green team leaders set up card tables and gave people a chance to speak out against the pipeline right in their houses of worship. And I had the honor of delivering a big stack of those postcards with a big thud to the State Department when I gave my testimony at the D.C. State Department hearings. I testified against the pipeline on a very sacred day in the Jewish tradition, my tradition. It was Erev Yom Kippur. So that night at sundown begins the holiest day of our year, when we kind of stop, when we kind of cut to the chase and get honest with ourselves about how we can be better people and whether our lives are on the right path. And I asked the State Department at that hearing, it seems to me that this was kind of a Yom Kippur moment for our country. We either had a choice to invest more and more in fossil fuels and in kind of in continuing to lead the climate over very dangerous tipping points, or to turn back and to say this isn't our future. This isn't life-giving. This isn't fair. This isn't thoughtful of future generations. It's short-sighted. And we had a large rally outside the State Department where, again, there was a strong faith contingent.
And just in one sentence, say what happened as a result of all of that in terms of the president's decision.
Well, in a very unlikely victory, or even partial victories are uncommon in this business. The 4 days after the very largest protest, an encircling of the White House that involved about 10,000 people, the president announced that the pipeline project would be delayed at least for 18 months and after the election.
The election. For just 1 minute, I want to play devil's advocate and throw at you some arguments that you hear opponents say. One of them is that labor unions and others say, wait a minute, these are jobs. These are jobs. Mm-hmm. And you're taking jobs away from Americans at a time when the economy is in crisis and people need jobs. And another argument you hear is, look, the pipeline's going to get built somewhere. The tar sands are going to be developed, and oil is going to be sold to China or to some other country, if not sold here. And we can get our oil from Venezuela and Saudi Arabia, or we can get it, more of it, from our friendly neighbor to the north, Canada. What's your rebuttal to the jobs argument and to the jobs, well, they're going to do it anyway, why not, we need oil, why not take it, you know, because it's going to happen no matter what. So what do you say to that?
The damage to our climate that would be caused by continuing to put greenhouse gases in our atmosphere is irreparable. We don't know exactly when that will hit that tipping point. We don't know exactly when we'll hit some point of no return. But the idea that a few thousand jobs is worth permanently destroying the climate on the only Earth any of us have ever lived on, you know, doesn't make any sense. Of course people need good, honest, living work, but all of us are human beings who live on Earth, and in the face of catastrophic, unprecedented, irreparable damage to the climate, it just seems like any short-term considerations pale in comparison.
It's like we need a place to live, right, too. We need a job, but we also need a place to live, like the planet.
I said to the State Department in my testimony, I said, every single one of you is also a human being who lives on Earth. And based on that should be our common ground in this conversation. And I know that about the people who need jobs, too, that we have to figure out a way to employ people in an honorable way that doesn't insist that they also permanently destroy the Earth their grandchildren have to live on in the process. It seems like a poverty of imagination to say that they have to choose that. As for the question of, well, if we do the right thing, won't other countries do the wrong thing? I mean, I'll leave to others the policy question of whether this pipeline, in fact, my understanding from others is that the United States is a major market for this oil, and that stopping this pipeline actually will address the tar sands development, or at least the pace of it. But more importantly, there is no other area of life where people say, I want everyone else to stop doing that wrong thing first, and then I'll do the right thing. You know, I'm not going to stop stealing until you can show me that every other person in my city isn't stealing. Or I'm not going to, you know, stop doing some bad thing until absolutely everyone is doing it. And yet you hear that kind of argument around our responsibility as a nation in climate change all the time. People say, well, why should we do right by our neighbors? Why should we think about future generations? Why should we have good policies on climate if China or India are not yet doing the right thing? And that's not a moral argument we would accept in any other sphere of life. I want my country to do the right thing. I hope that caring people in China will also ask their government to do the right thing. But that to me is neither here nor there. I want to ask my country to be a leader in doing the right thing on climate, regardless of how other people are behaving.
You know, you're right. It's really kind of funny. People talk about American exceptionalism and how we're a moral leader and we're a light to the world, except, never mind, when it comes to this. So it's a very intermittent standard of morality in terms of when it gets applied.
Reverend Mary Castellanos from the United Church of Christ testified at the State Department hearings against the pipeline also, and she said, "We think of ourselves as a high moral ground people. If we build this pipeline, we're going to have to think differently about that idea of ourselves, and that's a real cost that we'll pay."
I think you're right about that. I want to ask you about Interfaith Power and Light. What was the organization created to do, and what are some of the top things you're working on now? And because you're a network with state affiliates around the country, what are some interesting things happening in the states?
Reverend Canon Sally Bingham from the Episcopal Church founded Interfaith Power and Light because she felt strongly that there should be a religious response to the climate crisis, a uniquely religious response. And since then, it's been really beautiful to watch this work take off in so many different settings and with so many, both in many different geographic parts of the country and also with many different faith traditions feeling connected and engaged in it. Our work has sort of three big categories. We do education. We support congregations in greening their facilities and in changing their own impact on the environment, and we support religious communities in speaking out in advocacy campaigns on environmental issues. I'll speak specifically to here in DC because that's what I know best. We are learning as much as we can from the first 7 congregations locally to put up solar panels. They have been pioneers in figuring out some of the financing obstacles and in educating themselves about what they need to know to light their sanctuaries with renewable energy. And we've put out a booklet telling their stories and encouraging all of the congregations in the DC metro area to learn as much as they can from those pioneers and to work for the day when basically every faith congregation in the DC area is getting their power from the sun. It's been incredibly transformative for the congregations that have done it already. St. Albans Parish in Northwest calls the panels their new stained glass windows. It's a really powerful, transformative thing when congregations lead the way by embracing clean, renewable energy. In Maryland right now, we're working very hard to support groundbreaking offshore wind legislation, and we're talking a lot about the blessing of wind. Many different faith traditions both the Hebrew and Christian Bible and the Quran all describe the wind as God's breath and as a reminder of God's graciousness. And so we are working very hard alongside coalition partners to speak out on behalf of the opportunity we have on the Maryland coast to get our energy from wind power. And I guess we're trying to bring the message of climate change, the science, and also the question of what it means for us in our traditions to more and more congregations. We have a speakers bureau that speaks all, offers guest sermons, and I speak almost every weekend in a different congregation, opening this question of what is happening to our world, why is it happening, and what should we be doing about it?
And you work in an interfaith tradition, so you work with Muslims, Christians, Jews, and other faiths as well. Are there particular challenges or benefits to an interfaith collaboration?
One of the challenges of the climate crisis is that we're not going to be able to solve it unless we all work together. But one of the blessings is that it really calls our bluff about what makes us similar and what makes us different. We will only be able to solve this problem if we recognize that our common humanity and our common commitment to this planet is more important than any of the divisions and identities that may have gotten in our way in the past. So I see working on this issue as a on an interfaith basis as an incredible opportunity that the very difficult problem of climate change presents us with. A lot of times, I believe from my work on the ground that every congregation of every faith tradition has at least one person who feels like the green sheep in their community. They believe deeply in the importance of bringing these issues up in their faith community. They are passionate about finding those connections and taking action on what they've learned, but they often feel a little bit lonely. They sometimes don't have the support of the clergy, and they sometimes don't have the ear of their fellow congregants. So the value of this work is in bringing together the green sheep, supporting them and flocking together. Actually, the green sheep from the Presbyterian Church and the green sheep from the mosque and the green sheep from the synagogue actually have a lot in common with each other. They have a lot of similar struggles. They can inspire each other. A lot of the issues people encounter in their different congregations are very similar, in fact. Almost everybody drinks coffee after services, and almost everybody used to use styrofoam cups to do that and is trying to find other ways to gather together in fellowship with less waste. So we have a lively green leaders listserv where green leaders from all these different congregations can ask each other questions, can share encouragement and resources, and in the end, you know, lots of congregations have boilers in the basement that may need to be replaced and could probably be more efficient. And lots of congregations have unused land that perhaps could be gardened. and used it to grow vegetables. And in the end, there's so much wonderful interfaith cooperation that takes place through our work, but not dialogue for the sake of dialogue, but conversation for the sake of solving a problem together. It's very, very beautiful to see.
Sounds great. So I have a question about this wonderful interfaith collaboration and action, and some of it is advocacy, and then linking that to mainstream environmental groups, which are a pretty potent political presence and have been doing things for a long time, and the faith involvement in the environment isn't brand new either. Mm-hmm. So do you collaborate? Are you embedded in any kind of intrinsic way? Is it a more informal collaboration? How do you work with the more, or do you work with the more mainstream environmental groups? How do you rely on each other, that sort of thing?
Certainly locally in the D.C. area, I've been very grateful that we are a welcomed and central part of several different coalitions that are working on advocacy goals together. I believe that our unique role in these campaigns is that we can bring people to them who would not be hearing these messages otherwise. When people hear messages about environmental issues in their faith community, they listen differently, and they hear them as moral questions that are a matter of right and wrong. And so we bring new people to this work who would not have heard that message in any other setting. But I also believe that when those folks come to these coalitions, and when they speak from a deeply moral, spiritual place about why they support cleaner energy and why they are opposed to coal-fired power, they also get heard differently. It transforms these environmental coalitions when there are powerful, articulate faith voices coming to this work from a moral perspective. It also gets political attention in a way sometimes that the mainstream environmental groups, the usual suspects, cannot. So I deeply, deeply believe in the unique value of what we're doing. We are bringing new people to the work, and we are also transforming how that movement is heard when we speak.
A subset of faith groups are conservative white evangelicals, and they, on a lot of issues, poll a little bit differently. And polling shows that they're somewhat more skeptical of climate change, somewhat less politically involved in these efforts. I'm not sure that's true across generations, but I would like to know what your experience is of working with any evangelical congregations. Do you see a generational divide? Is there a skepticism? What do you find?
I've had the pleasure of working with a number of organizations that are really leading the way with the evangelical community on those issues. I make great use of a book called Climate for Change by Catherine Hayhoe, who is a IPCC scientist at Texas Tech University in Lubbock, and is also married to an evangelical Christian pastor. And her book does a beautiful job of explaining the science and also contextualizing it within her Christian theology. I've also had done a lot of wonderful work with the Evangelical Environmental Network, and have been extremely impressed with the clarity of their vision and their very strong message about really calling their community to take seriously what it means to be pro-life. The community is very strongly understands itself to be pro-life, and so they've pushed to say, now wait a minute, shouldn't we support EPA mercury regulations that would protect unborn children from mercury pollution? Isn't that what it also means to be pro-life? So they've used the very language of their own community and the very self-understanding of their own community to push more in the direction of being supportive of environmental legislation and environmental positions. There's been some great work done by a group called Blessed Earth. Dr. Matthew Sleeth and his wife Nancy Sleeth, who are doing a number of programs at the National Cathedral right here in town in the coming years. These are all voices from within the evangelical Christian world that are standing up and saying, for us to live out our tradition, for us to really take Christianity seriously, we have to care for God's creation. And everything they tell me indicates that, especially among that next generation, that message is really resonating.
And it seems to be resonating on a global way, too, in terms of poor communities across the world that will be disproportionately affected, seems to be resonant as well.
Yes. Reverend Jim Ball from the Evangelical Environmental Network wrote a book called Climate Change and the Risen Lord, where he really talks about the impact climate change is having on communities around the world. And in particular, there are a lot of evangelical Christian communities in the United States that have strong ties with missionaries doing work in Africa and countries where they're seeing the impact of climate change firsthand. And the message of those missionaries when they say, you need to pay attention to this because I'm watching it cause suffering, is very powerful.
All of this sounds very hopeful, and it feels very authentic and very much on a community level around the country. Given all of this, why is climate change such a disputed, why has it become such a disputed partisan issue versus just a matter of science? Why is it such a hot-button issue that it's part of a divide? How did that happen? Why is that? And how do we get over it?
I can't speak to how it got that way, but I can tell you that talking about climate change in congregations is uniquely effective for a couple of reasons. One is that when people are in their congregations, in their faith communities, they are listening with their moral ears. It's the place they come already to think about really taking their own values seriously and pushing themselves and their communities to really live out those values. It's the place they come to think about right and wrong. So when you have a conversation about climate change in someone's faith community, in their church, in their synagogue, they hear that conversation even without having to say anything explicitly. they hear that conversation as a conversation about how to do right in the world. So I deeply believe in the value of simply having those conversations in the buildings where we pray and where we strive to be better people. That by itself is extremely transformative. The second thing is that people have a lot of feelings about climate science. And I try to warn people when we have these conversations, when I'm showing them a graph of global average temperature for the last 150 years, there aren't too many graphs where looking at them would make you have a lot of feelings. But when people hear about climate science, they have a lot of feelings. And sometimes I think when we try to have the conversation about the science in a setting where those feelings are not acknowledged and not named, that people feel overwhelmed and defensive and shut down, and that some of the denial that we see is actually people having a hard time with the feelings they have about how they would have to understand the world differently if this science were true. So when I speak about climate in a faith setting, that's already the place people come to celebrate, to pray, to grieve. So this is already a setting in which it's okay to talk about feelings. And I warn people before I take out my slides, I say, my experience is that people have feelings about this stuff, and I have a lot of feelings about this stuff. Some of the feelings you're going to feel when I talk about climate science, you're going to feel like you don't want to be here. You're going to feel like you want to kind of leave or think about something else. You're going to feel like this woman isn't a scientist. I don't know who she is. I want to see some footnotes. You're going to think, there must be something on the internet that would debunk everything I'm going to tell you. And I just invite them to acknowledge those feelings and to try to keep listening. And by saying that in advance and then checking in several times during the presentation so that people can say where they are, I find that that's extremely helpful for having a productive conversation about climate science. I think one of the things that climate science does is it challenges our theologies. And I believe everyone has a theology, but it's our idea about how the universe works and what our role in it is. And by suggesting that maybe we have some role now in the weather where we never did before, and that we might actually be changing the way the earth works forever in a way that will change the kind of world our grandchildren will live in a way that our ancestors who wrote the Bible couldn't have imagined. I mean, that's really unsettling, scary stuff. And I think the more we can acknowledge that people are deeply threatened by this information and be whole and honest in our brokenheartedness together, I think that's the way to have a real conversation about climate science.
Well, and it goes back to one of the things you were saying earlier when we were talking about Durban, the need to acknowledge responsibility And linked to that can be guilt, and linked to that can be feeling like you're bad. And in houses of worship, there's something called repentance, where people confess and repent, which is maybe a more appropriate place and an open way to think about some of these issues of responsibility and legitimate guilt in a way that doesn't feel like you're being bashed.
Totally. And I think the other way I try to offer the people I'm speaking to real hope, hope that I really can believe in too. I think sometimes those of us in the climate world fall into making a very scary presentation about sort of apocalyptic scenarios and then saying, but you can all change your light bulbs, as if like that's going to make it all okay.
That's going to help, right?
And I think when we don't believe our own hope message, people can feel it, and it feels false to them. So I've thought a lot about what is the real hope I can offer when I talk about these issues, that a hope that I can share. And I try to think about, well, what would the cost be of not caring about this issue? You know, how small would I have to make my world to not have to care about climate change? Well, first, I would need to not care about anyone who doesn't live in the United States, because probably those of us in the United States will have a variety of resources to defend against some of these impacts. And okay, so now I've made my world small enough to exclude everyone who doesn't live in the United States. And I will also have to not care about anyone who will be alive on Earth after I'm gone, because some of those the hardest impacts of climate change will impact subsequent generations. So I need to let go of any concern I might have about grandchildren or children of mine and what their experience on Earth will be like. And then
it's getting smaller.
Yeah, so now I've made my world small enough that I don't care about people in the future, and I don't care about people who don't live in my country. And then I have to not care about any other species. I mean, we're talking about something like a third of all species. All species, all animals, all plants may not be able to adapt fast enough to rapid climate changes by 2100. So then I need to basically let go of any attachment I have or any connection I feel to any other life on Earth. And at that point, I don't have to care about climate change, but I have made my world so small, yeah. And it's so lonely. I mean, it's spiritually lonely. Like, what do our religious traditions push us to do but the opposite, right? To feel more interconnected with other human beings, to feel more part of traditions that transcend generations and are eternal and will last after we're gone. I mean, and to feel more kinship or connectedness with the natural world and with other life forms. There's nothing to me that goes more against the message of our religious traditions than to make my world so small that I don't have to care about this. So to me, the real hope I can offer people is that it will be really heartbreaking. It will mean you might have to change how you live. It will mean that you might have to feel concerned about your future generations. But the way forward, the brokenhearted way, is actually the way to stay whole and to stay interconnected and to not be so lonely in the world. And not to be so feel so lonely in the universe, and that's the most hopeful thing I can offer folks, is the community in which to address these problems together.
And to that I say amen. Thank you.
Thank you.